The Mario Rosenstock Podcast. Thanks to Home. Finance made easy when you shop tech, electrical, appliances, kitchens, and much more. Flexify Europe Limited, trading as Home, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Coming up on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock Podcast.
People used to use their ears and their own taste, and numbers didn't matter. Like if someone saw Amy Winehouse playing in a pub, they wouldn't need to go, well, what's her numbers on TikTok? What's her in? And I don't like that. Because for me, if I hear someone that's an incredible singer and I hear their songs, I don't care how many numbers they have on TikTok or Instagram. I'm going to work with them.
I'm a sucker for a great conversation about music and songwriting, and it's rarely a short conversation when I have one. So when I sat down to record an episode of the podcast with Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter Ruth Ann Cunningham, it turned into two episodes of conversations out on this podcast. Ruth Ann has written songs for some of the world's biggest performers, including Niall Horan, Britney Spears, Westlife, Martin Garrix, and One Direction. She has so many great stories to share and so much to say about the music industry and how it all works. We played out part one of our conversation on the last episode, and this week we bring you the rest. Ruth Ann and I talk about the role social media plays in the modern industry and why she's not too happy about it at all. She tells me how things work when it comes to royalties. How do you get paid? How songwriters get paid? We talk about why a legend like Bruce Springsteen wouldn't be a success if he started out today, and lots more.
There's not one person in a suit going, she's a star, he's a star. That doesn't matter anymore. It's like the public will decide, and... Yes. People are deciding who they want to be their stars. Jeff Buckley commercially flopped. Bruce Springsteen's first three albums flopped, but he's Bruce Springsteen, right? So if Bruce Springsteen was first coming out now, he would have been dropped after that first album because it flopped. Whereas back then, they believed in him and it was like, okay, we're going to try another one. There's amazing ones like It's Not Who You Know, It's Who You Avoid. There's another one from Steph Jones who wrote Espresso saying, don't be an arsehole, like, just be a nice person. Mm. There's loads of gems of these amazing pieces of advice.
Part two of this great conversation with Ruth Ann Cunningham coming up shortly, right after I was away in Rome for a few days. And when I came back, I couldn't even go on the M50 to get home because of the fuel protesters. This is what everybody's talking about at the moment. Even my hotline is devoted to the views about it.
You've reached the Mario Rosenstock fuel protester hotline. Please leave a message after the tone.
Hello, Rosenstock. Get your message out to these pinko liberal listeners of yours. I have no time for these fuel protesters. I stocked up on a load of fuel at great price before all this kicked off, by the way. So if motorists want to head out to their nearest airport, I will sort you out. Now, it's aviation fuel, granted, so costs of €475 per half litre. But if you fill up, you get 5 Ryanair scratch cards and a panini included. Okay? Half price. Now shut up and stop protesting.
Hello, Mario. This is Pascal Donoghue calling you from Washington, D.C. I'm watching the coverage of the protests from my new home here. I'm feeling very, very sorry for everyone involved. Obviously, I would have liked to be in a position to negotiate and mediate myself, but that no longer remains a course of action available for me. I understand the different issues and why it is so divisive, and I can clearly see the point of each side of the divide. But I'll tell you something for nothing now. If I'm at home in North Dublin, I'd be getting into me bleeding car and driving straight over to the nearest blockade and knocking 7 shades of shite out of these assholes with a knuckle duster and a baseball cap and lifting them out of it. How dare they behave like that? Micheál Martin's talking tough right now, but these lads only understand action. I would have sorted it out in seconds, but hopefully we can do something more civilised.
And exclusive new comedy every week on the Mario Rosenstock podcast. And you can get in touch with me if you want me to cover anything in a certain way. New characters that you'd like me to feature if I haven't found them already, or sketches you would like me to do, or new guests that you'd like me to have that I haven't had on. But also my thanks go to Hum Finance for coming on board as sponsors of the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Humm is a finance company based in Ireland with over 30 years experience globally, and we are delighted on the Mario Rosenstock podcast to be partnering up with them to bring you this show every week. Humm provides flexible payment solutions for customers of a wide range of retailers like IKEA, Harvey Norman, Easy Living Interiors, Easy Living Furniture, and DID, to name just a few. Whether you're buying a kitchen, a laptop or TV, some nice new jewellery or clothing, whatever it might be, Humm is there to make those purchases for you and pay back in bite-sized, easy payments. It couldn't be easier. Humm is there for the big things and the little things in life. And now they're here for the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Thank you, Humm, for coming on board. So, it's time for the second part of my fascinating chat with one of Ireland's big singer-songwriters, Ruth Ann Cunningham. In this half, we chatted a lot more about the modern-day music industry and how it all works, starting with the role that social media now plays. What do you think of the impact of social media on the picking process? The idea that talent can emerge now through the... So, for example, you know, the classic... Not about a person, a woman or a guy or a girl. They can't knock on the door. They don't get in. They do get in, but then they're told they're not good enough. The other people tell them... They get ultimately refused by everybody. They put something up online and they find their home there. Then everybody starts going, this person is brilliant. What do you think? And what do you think of that? Do you think it's been a democratization?
I think that it's good and bad. So I'm kind of both. I think social media is incredible. I think, like, for me, I was that. You know, no one would sign me because they were like, she's a songwriter. They just want me to write the hits for everyone else. And the people made the vow go and. And now it's almost at 1 billion views on TikTok and it's in thousands of weddings. And you know, so I've gotten to do amazing things because that song, and I've been able to do that. I was with the indie label, but I've never been with the major because it's like, well, you didn't believe in it. So, you know, I'm not going to sign with you now. But what I think is incredible is that there's not one person in a suit going, she's a star. He's a star. That doesn't matter anymore. It's like the public will decide and the people are deciding who they want to be their stars. And I think famously Simon Cowell said he never didn't get the Billie Eilish thing. And it's like, how would you not get that? And I know someone who worked close with Simon that said to me one time, oh yeah, I had Bruno in to write songs for Leona Lewis. I never thought he was a star. I never would have signed him. So those type of people in those powerful positions, they don't get to say anymore.
But Ruth Ann, it's patently ridiculous that a 55-year-old man should be deciding who is... That 55-year-old men all over the world are deciding... 55-year-old men with jeans up to their nipples are deciding who the new 22-year-old girl is.
But back in the 90s, they had the money, and whoever had the money to invest got to pick who they wanted to invest in.
I know. I'm saying it's ridiculous, though.
Ridiculous. But... and sometimes they get it right. Sometimes they've gotten it right on their pick, you know, and sometimes they've had to spend a lot of money to get the person to the star status. You know, it's the investment that then gets that person in front of everyone because you used to have TV and radio and that was it. Shove them down their throats enough, they'll be big. But now that's not enough anymore. It's community, it's building, so anyone can make it. I think that's amazing. I think that, you know, Teddy Swims blowing up online first, and like, I think people being able to have their own audiences. Yes. I love the idea of an artist having their own audience. I might not know that artist, but they're selling out shows.
Correct.
That's like, everyone should be able to find their audience and play to them and have a career.
Right, same with comedy, Ruth Ann. I mean, like, God almighty, right? So I had the absolute honor and of being able to play the Three Arena last year, right?
Amazing.
And I kind of looked up, and I was looking up the Three Arena, and MCD were looking at all the artists that were playing the Three Arena that year, and they went, you're beside them. And I went, I was looking at all the artists and I was going, wow, Jimmy Carr is playing the Three Arena, and like, look, Ricky Gervais on the night before me, right?
That's amazing.
But hold on. And then I went, who's this fucking dope on 3 days before me? And I went, I've never heard of any of these guys. And that's because they've made their name in America online and everything. And they're huge and they're sold out in the Three Arena. So you're right. Let's play to your audience.
Find your audience and play to. So I love that. I love that anyone has skin in the game. You can't count anybody out. Anybody can make it at any point. I love that. Now, where it does get, with your question, is that what I don't like about it is that people used to use their ears and their own taste, and numbers didn't matter. Like if someone saw Amy Winehouse playing in a pub, they wouldn't need to go, well, what's her numbers on TikTok? What's her in? And I don't like that, because for me, if I hear someone that's an incredible singer and I hear their songs, I don't care how many numbers they have on TikTok or Instagram. I'm going to work with them. But I don't like sometimes now, and we all do it, like, you know, you'll go, I love that song, and people will instantly go to, or they're looking through TikTok and they'll only watch the videos with the most views because they think, well, society is telling me this is the strongest one, because that one, and brands and everyone will go, what are the numbers? What are the numbers? What are the numbers? What are the numbers? And numbers will influence someone to think differently and go, oh, but she only has, you know, 200, you know, she only has that amount of followers, so she mustn't be that good. And so I don't like that value has become what the numbers are. And because I don't agree with that. Like I said, Jeff Buckley commercially flopped. Bruce Springsteen's first three albums flopped, but he's Bruce Springsteen, right? So if Bruce Springsteen was first coming out now, he would have been dropped after that first album because it flopped. Whereas back then they believed in him and it was like, okay, we're going to try another one. We'll try another one. You know, so it's like, I don't like that the numbers now will make investors go, all right, we're pulling it. Because sometimes it takes time. No Doubt took 10 years before they did Don't Speak. And the A&R knew that and said, I believe in you guys, but you need to tour, you need experience, and then we'll start releasing. And they're frustrated, but he believed in them. So it's like, but nowadays, you put a song on TikTok, if it doesn't go within 2 weeks, the label move on. And they go, that's not a hit. We're moving on. And that's just not true, because sometimes, you know, people might not be seeing it. There's a lot of noise now. It needs the right, like for me, with some songs, I've gotten sync placements. I've had songs come out, flop. And then at the right movie scene, the right moment for the song, the song goes. So I'm like, so it was never the song's problem. So for me, I don't like, that's the one drawback, is that sometimes now we're putting, and even as artists ourselves, the song comes out, if we put up a piece of content and it doesn't do well, we think it's the song. And I don't like that, because I don't believe that.
I understand you. Yeah, I understand. Yeah. Very, very interesting.
I don't want that value to be.
Now, here's another thing. I mean, I suppose I started by saying, imagine all the geniuses we didn't get to discover in the 70s, 60s, 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. All the geniuses who we've never heard of, who were out there. Yeah. Because they either they were never allowed in the door, or they gave up, or they tried a little bit but they got stopped, or they never even got onto vinyl or cassette because they were never even given the budget to make a first record. Can you imagine all the geniuses we didn't ever get to meet?
100%, and I worry about that now, because I go, Thom Yorke would not be on TikTok being like, this is the song of the summer. Like he would never. So are we gonna miss some new geniuses? I don't know, you know, because some people who are amazing artists are not good at social media. No. They're not good. They come out, they sing their song and they blow you away, but they might not be good at that other part. And these days you have to be in order. Yeah. It's the main way to market your music. So I do worry about that sometimes in social media as well, that we might be missing the person in their room who's literally like a genius savant and isn't getting to be seen because they're not.
Yeah,
you know,
it's like what I'm saying to you. It's like that thing of like, she's a genius. Mm-hmm. Well, I've never heard of her. Yeah, well, she is a genius. Like, I mean, that song, she's written three of these things, and by any measure, they're just amazing. Well, look, why haven't I never heard of her? So she mustn't be a genius. And that's, of course, when the commodification of art, where basically art is turned into numbers and art and ultimately money. And you're kind of going, hang on, it just isn't, you know, it just isn't like that.
And even the landscape has changed so much. Like even radio, like not to be bad on radio, but radio used to break records. Yes. Now radio won't, like now it's so interesting, especially from a songwriting perspective and an artist perspective, radio's the last piece now. They won't play your song until it's going. They won't take a chance and go, well, I like it. Like Jewel was played by accident or something on some show and it ended up, that's how it went. And so, but now because it's like, well, you have to play these songs that are doing well. These have to be played because these are already on Spotify doing well. Instead of DJs going, well, I really like this song, I'm going to play it.
You're onto something. You're onto something, because, I mean, one of my best friends who died years ago, Tony Fenton, the great Tony Fenton, the DJ, Tony Fenton. Tony was one of those old school DJs, a bit like Ian Dempsey, where they can actually listen to a song. They're not musicians. It's amazing. It's an amazing career. Sorry, it's an amazing job. These things called DJs.
Yeah.
A real DJ. Where they're not musicians. Like, Ian does not play a musical instrument. Tony did never play a musical instrument. Tony cannot sing. Ian can sing like a little bit like karaoke or in a bar.
Yeah.
But they can sit in a room, listen to a song for the first time and have a very good idea if they think that's a good song. And I am musical and I have pitch and everything and I can, I'm a creative person, but I can do that. I can't do that. I remember Tony sending me a song and it was Future Islands and it was called Seasons. Seasons change. And I remember hearing the first thing and seeing your man doing his funny dance and I'm going, Tony, that's bollocks. And he's going, nah, dude, that's a hit. And I remember a few weeks later it became a hit. And he knew it, kind of knew it. He had a feel for what a hit felt like. Do you know that kind of thing?
Yeah, and you know, we've had great Irish DJs. Like Dave Fanning was amazing at knowing that and doing that. But now, you see, here's where it's different these days. Now, a DJ or a playlisting editor will like get a song in, maybe listen to it, but they will look for numbers. And they'll go, what's it doing on Spotify? Where is it in the charts? Has it charted? And instead of closing their eyes and listening and going, I believe in that record. I think that's a smash. And that's something that's a bit of a shame. But, you know, there's still amazing music being made. And even from Ireland right now, we're in such an amazing music moment.
Yeah, we are.
Back and we've got Kingfisher and Amble and C-Matt and great artists. But I do sometimes go, I wish they should dig in a bit more. There's loads of amazing Irish artists out there. And I think everyone should dig in a little bit more and just use their ears like they used to do back in the day and go, I like this. I'm going to play this. And the thing you're saying.
Why don't you do it? Why don't you do it, Ruth Ann? Why don't you dig in a little bit more and just become the record company, the label and the.
Oh, maybe I should.
That's your label.
The thing is, like, What those people have is just great taste. That's what I call great taste. Mm. You know, just great ear for great song and great taste. When I'm older, I've always said I'd love to, you know, have a label or be a manager or something like that. Because especially for Irish artists, and I'm working with a lot of Irish artists at the moment. Yeah. You know, I've been in Lyra, and yes. I'm working with a new artist called Sinead Ashioka, who I think is literally incredible.
Yeah, and Lyra, Sinead Ashioka.
She's amazing. And so,
I had Lyra on my podcast and she was, I'll tell you one thing about Lyra, actually. She had that kind of little star quality in terms of her particular star quality was her energy, her vivacity. So she had that kind of, she had a kind of a charisma, party charisma. She can come into a room and she has a lot of fucking energy.
And hilarious.
Really funny and a big personality is what I'm trying to say. She had a really big personality.
Yeah. So I just want to be in writing with all these amazing, incredible artists and writing more hits, hopefully, and having more songs in the world. And my favorite thing is people not always knowing that I've written something and it being on the radio. It could even be my voice. Amazing. You know, I've had dance records out on Irish radio and people don't know it's me singing, but it's me singing, amazing. You know, so I kind of love that.
What do you think of Taylor Swift? I mean, she is something else, really, because she seems to. I mean, you'd probably know way. You obviously know way more about her, but on the cursory sort of the way I see her on documentaries and everything, the way it comes across is that she has her hands around everything. She's the ones that's coming up with the. She's coming up with the idea, the emotion. She's the song doctor and the ideas, the immersion. She's both.
She is. Yeah.
She's a genius as well. Like.
She is. She's an incredible, incredible, incredible songwriter. Like for me, Taylor is like one of the best songwriters. You know, she will go down as one of the best songwriters ever, I think. Mm. You know, with that, you know, along with Ed Sheeran, along with, you know, those lists of like Paul McCartney, Elton John, Carole King. You know, when we look back, Taylor will be on that list. And as will Ed Sheeran and as will Ray. I think Ray will be on that list.
Really?
I think there's. And Amy Winehouse. Yeah, I do think that, you know, and Taylor's been doing it for so long. And for her to just keep up that type of level.
It's a compulsive. It's compulsive. She seems to have a compulsive need to write.
Yeah, I think, but it's probably because, like, when you're a songwriter, it's just in your veins.
You need to get it out.
You're going to write forever. You just need to get it out. Yeah. It's therapy almost. It's how she processes things, how I process things. It's like you almost, like, even when, you know, I have had my children and I've had taken breaks to have to, I'm still like breastfeeding the baby and writing a song in my bed. And like, you know, it's how I, it's definitely her therapy in a way. And it's mine, you know, it's how we process. It's how we show up in
it's
the
breathing.
World.
It's breathing. It's breathing almost for you. It's like a breathing thing. The sketch stuff, when I was about, when I started doing this, when I was about 28, about a year into it, my brain started changing. Otherwise I wouldn't have been able to do it. I had to hardwire my brain basically into going, every single thing you see in your life is potentially a sketch.
That is literally what I say to people. You have to live to write. It's one of my biggest quotes. You have to live to write. Every conversation, and it's the same with comedy, you know, every conversation you have could be a song. Anything anyone says, someone could come into the session with a chocolate juice and you end up writing juicy chocolate. Yeah. Like you just, anything can be the song. And so you have to stay open to it all. You've got to be open. The song is floating and you just need to, and you need to just be open to it, and it's going to fall on
you. You are 100% right. And that's exactly, I remember Keith Richards said that as well. I remember, they were at an interview with Keith Richards and they were saying, how do you and Mick Jagger like write the songs? And Keith was there, no, man, I don't write any songs. Man, what do you mean? Man, the songs are out there, man.
They just come there.
You got to be on the right wavelength. Mm-hmm. So he's just like, you just got to be in tune. And some days you are in tune and some days you're not. Sometimes you're like, you're in that place where you're listening to things happening and you're feeling things. And you're, I suppose, receptive would be a nice word. Mm-hmm. And other days you're too busy and you've got shitty things on your mind, like, you know, what do I need for dinner or all that stuff. So it's very, very interesting, the whole creative process. Is there a song out there that you go, I wish I had written that. That's the one. One that you didn't write that you go, Christ. Oh.
There's so many songs like that. I grew up loving. Yeah. It's hard for me to pick a favorite song.
One, what did you grow up loving?
Okay, one that I wish I wrote was Love is a Losing Game, Amy Winehouse. I just think it's just incredible. Yeah. More recently, Taste by Sabrina Carpenter. I just love that song. Yeah. My ex-boyfriend wrote it. John Ryan, my ex wrote that.
Oh my God.
We've written One Direction songs. Like, we're still friends. He was at my wedding. Yeah. Like, we're good. But and I'm so proud of him. But when I heard that, I was like, oh, it's just so good. It's such a great concept and lyrically.
I remember at the beginning when you were talking to me and you mentioned it's great artists when you were young, your parents listening to them. Mm. And you mentioned Carole King. And I was,
Carole King.
Too late, baby, now it's too late.
Yeah. And that was I'll tell you what.
Go on.
The whole album I wish I wrote.
Tapestry. Yeah. Fuck's sake.
James Taylor, Fire and Rain
is
one I wish I wrote. And Fleetwood Mac, the entire Rumours album. Dreams, Landslide. I wish I wrote all them songs. And the Jeff Buckley, Grace. Yeah. I'm just like, that song, every time I listen to it, it takes me on this journey. It feels like about five songs in one.
I'll tell you a great song.
You Should Have Come Over. Lover, You Should Have Come Over. Wish I wrote that.
I'll tell you a great one, because we just did we did this thing, which was a huge, big success on Today FM there in the last month. The 100 greatest Irish songs of all time. Yeah. And it reached out there. It got a lot of things. So, I mean, there was like Christy Moore and everything, and Grace and the Wolf Tones were on and everything. The boys are back in town. Yeah. You're really going back, you know. But kind of high up in the situation, you know, you had a good few Cranberries and a bit of Sinead. And, you know, Mandinka was a great song that was up there, you know, lovely. What about a song to introduce yourself to the world almost?
Oh,
like that song, you know?
I love that song. And I actually predicted that Zombie was going to win.
Did you?
Yeah. When we did the Three Arena, with Hot Press, and they were talking backstage, and I said, Zombie's going to win. Zombie was number one, wasn't it? One of my songs I wrote when Niall got on there, Slow Hands, was in the top.
Top 100. It did.
So I got one. Because I was like,
the top 100, because you see, you didn't see what I saw, which was, I saw songs between 100 and 400.
And 400, wow.
And you're just basically going, are you saying this song is number 380? I mean, there were some amazing songs in the 300s. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
And,
you know, so anybody in the top 100 is an amazing thing. But one,
I'm glad as an Irish songwriter, I got in there.
Absolutely.
In the top
super work. Super work, Ruth Ann.
But
one of the ones that I love, and it was Cranberry's Dreams. And the reason I loved it was because obviously it's her voice and obviously it's her vibe and her idea. And it's she was singing about what it's like to fall in love for the first time. And it's of course that can only happen to you once.
100%.
You can fall in love many times, but no, first time, no, only once. And she sings about what it's like falling in love. But what's beautiful about the song is the arrangement. She sings it twice.
Absolutely.
One as one voice and the other as the alternative voice. And it's like as if there's two people inside her talking to each other. It's like as if she's having this internal dialogue talking about it. It's just fucking really extraordinary piece of work.
Oh, just stunning. Mm. Absolutely stunning. And we did a version as Irish Woman in Harmony. And just even getting into the bones of it and restructuring and rearranging it and trying to get into her head, like into their head of how they did. I mean, it's a masterpiece. The Cranberry stuff is, you know, linger, like the strings and absolutely beautiful. And, you know, some of the best Irish music of all time.
I wanted to ask you a business question. Cause I haven't read your book yet, but it's in the title. It's in the chapters. So one of the things I'll take it by autobiographical. So one of the things I had to do was, in 2005, I had the Christmas Irish number one single and it was called Think I Better Leave Right Now. And it was me as Roy Keane singing, I think I better leave right now, when he left Manchester United.
I remember. Yeah.
So it was number one. But before we got to number one, we had to discuss with the publisher, right? Because we had to get the rights. And we had to get them really quick. And we said there'd be no chance of getting it unless we said we're doing it for a special charity. Mm-hmm. So we did it for charity and the publisher said, okay, so Mario's not going to take all the money for this. And we went, no, I'm not going to take the money. I want to just get this song out there because it's Roy Keane, but we'll do it for this charity. And the publisher was kind enough to give us the publishing rights. Okay.
Right.
So what a lot of people don't understand is that when you hear a singer singing a song on the radio, they're often not getting all the money. Money is through publishing, and the person who wrote the song and the people who wrote the song kind of are rightfully regarded as the great people behind this song.
Yeah, so, the rights holders.
So my question is, how does it work out? Let's say I'm Ruth Ann. Well, you're Ruth Ann. Yeah. So you're Ruth Ann and you go, I got a song called He Lied to Me. And I've written it all. And I actually have the chorus as well. And here it is, actually. And here's me doing the demo. And then they go, well, Ruth Ann, this is a fucking stone cold classic. My friend Chapel Rowan wants this song. Now, how does that work out?
So there's different, in my book, I talk about all these scenarios and I go into it in detail. So it works all different ways. If you're in with an artist, so say if I'm in with Niall or I'm in with John Legend or people I've written songs with, right? We just split it equally. Or, you know, if...
And when you say equally, would you then be allowed to say 50-50?
If we've written the song together.
In the room together, and you. So there have been the things where you and Niall can write a song, and Niall and you agree, we're going to go 50-50 on this.
Yeah. Me, John, anyone I've written with, right? Because we've written the song together. Say if there's also been scenarios where, you know, an artist might say, hey, I've got this song, it's missing like a verse, or it needs a bridge, or it needs some tweaks. So they bring me in on it a little bit after the fact, and I help them finish it, or I add something to it, whatever. I wouldn't take equal in that scenario.
No.
I would take what I think is the fair contribution for what I did. So I've been on songs that I've written where I've 10%. I've been on songs where I've written 90%.
What about if they offered you a fee? What if they offered you $100,000? You don't do fees?
No. You don't do a fee. Now we're getting into a whole different thing, but you also can get a fee, but you always have to retain publishing because that's the main revenue for a songwriter is the publishing. So if you've written, it's intellectual property. So if you've written a song, you need to always have royalties and that's how you mainly would get paid. So you never should be bought out for that. So basically, you discuss splits. So if you and me go in to write a song today, say we're here and write a song, we're 50-50 if we write the song from scratch. If I sit down at the piano and I sing you a verse and a chorus, technically, I've come to you with this fully formed idea. So you might write a verse with me, I'll cut you in a little bit, we'll discuss, and that's negotiable. There might be also scenarios, which I've had, where the DJ comes in, hears a song, and then adds a track to it, and they come in and they take a percentage. So it's case by case. It's always different. It's never the same. And yeah, so publishing is always negotiated case by case.
Your song is, if your song was on an album in 2003, let's say, and the album was the number one album in the world, you would earn a lot of money.
Back in before streaming,
yes.
Before streaming, when there was physical copies, CDs,
correct,
vinyls, tapes, everything. Yes, there was a lot of money to be made from the physical selling.
But that's what I'm saying.
Music.
So there's not as much money now to be made from selling records.
Yes, from streaming. So, okay, I'll try. This is all in my book as well. But there are two sides of revenue for a song. There's the master side and the publishing side. The publishing is the songwriters, right? So the people who wrote the song. The master side is the people who own the master. And that's the recording of the song. So if you and me record a song today and we record it in your house, you're the master on it because we recorded it in your house. So essentially you own it. If we recorded it in my studio, I own the studio, I'm the master owner. If a label have an artist and they pay for me, for their artist to come to my studio and record, they own the master, okay? And then what happens is that on the, so the master side is for the, that recording of that song, okay? The sound recording. And that's where the artist gets paid, the label get paid. The publishing side is for the publishing, the songwriting, right? So producers normally get paid from the master, the artist gets paid from the master. So if I vocal a song and I'm the vocalist, I get on the master side. If I write it and I sing it, I get the publishing side and the master side. The label don't get any of the publishing side usually because they just get the master side, right? So just to explain, so back in the day, there was a lot more money because there was physicals being sold, which was like $21.99 or $15.99. Radio is a good moneymaker still because it's about a dollar or a pound or a euro per play for songwriters, right? That pound per play, say euro per play, has to be split between all the songwriters. So if four of us write a song, we're splitting a pound four ways, right? Just this might be complicated, but in my book it's very well done in a simple way. So just to break it down for you, right now in streaming world, deals were done with the labels that songwriters didn't get to have any say in, where the labels did a deal with the streaming. Now the labels are obviously going to want the master to earn more because that's their stake in the game. So basically right now as it stands, a million streams. So if you put out a song and it streams about a million times, the publishing is worth about £400 euro. I'm going to do pounds because that's the figures that I know in the, for certain, £400, right? The master side of the same record is 4,000. So that pay gap is like, so multiplied by 10, basically.
Yeah.
So the label and the label side, the master side of the record is going to make 10 times what the publishing side makes. So if you go up to 10 million, you've 4,000 for the publishing, 40,000 for the master.
Yeah.
And so you can see there's a massive pay gap there. So that's the, and that £400 needs to be split between all the songwriters. So if there's four of us, we get £100
yes.
each. Whereas the label often own 80% of that master and the artist earns 20. So, and the producer will take about 3 or 4% of that 20, of the artist 20. Now at the moment, we're fighting for songwriters to now get master points. So at the moment, I request on all songs I write that I have a master point, which is 1 point on the record, so that I'm also earning from the master side because the streaming side revenue can be so low.
Yeah. Here's one thing I would wonder about. Because records have disappeared, physical records have disappeared.
Yes.
And because all bands and all artists now are turning their attention towards live performance. So, for example, an artist, instead of doing one tour, or sorry, instead of an artist doing a tour every 4 years, an artist will now tour every year, right? Let's say.
Yes.
And
yes.
I'm wondering, should there not be a kind of an idea whereby the songwriters of those songs are cut in towards a little bit of that revenue, even though it's live performance, because they've just replaced selling music with selling out stadiums, and the songwriter's song is still being used, but not getting paid.
Yeah, like it's same with like merch. A lot of our lyrics are used for merch or, you know, we should, I think, you know, we should get a cut of some of the merch that has our lyrics on it. And sometimes for me as well, like a song that I might write for a DJ could up his pay packet, because if it's a massive hit, he then goes from getting 200 grand an hour to 500 grand an hour.
Correct. For a set.
And we don't. So, yeah. So, you know, I don't think that'll ever happen. Mm. But that's why I think cutting writers into the master is the fairest way to kind of combat that, and song fees and everything. So in my book, I talk about the new industry standard, which is what we're trying to do.
Yes.
Which is, and it is happening.
Very
is
interesting. Happening.
So yeah, it's all in my book that people can read about.
Oh, very interesting. And I mean, your book looks like an amazing read. And I mean, just on that royalties thing, I remember back to one of our old friends there, Dolly Parton. I remember she said, do you remember Elvis wanted I Will Always Love You?
Yes.
And they told her, so Elvis will be taking 50% of this. And she went, no, he won't. And they went, no, this is a deal breaker, Dolly. And she went, well, the deal is broken then. So I'm not doing the deal. And she said she really regrets that Elvis never sang I Will Always Love You. But she said, Whitney did it in the end. Yeah. And of course, that's why Whitney was on her Christmas card list every year, because many millions from I Will Always Love You.
Yeah, and the thing with Whitney is that in that scenario, this is what I always want people to remember. Whitney was the singer, one of the best singers of all time. Whitney was not a songwriter. She's always said she's not a songwriter.
No.
And she was okay with that. Mm. And I think that it's okay to be a great singer and to have Dolly Parton, like, you know, and I think sometimes these days people want to be part of it all, even if that's not their strong suit. Mm. And for me, I'm like, Whitney did I Will Always Love You. She didn't write it. She won a Grammy for it. But she, guess what? She got all that master money though with the label. So it's like, you'll still, like, everyone needs to just, you know, you don't have to take from the songwriters. You can still all, we can all win.
Correct.
So, yeah.
One of the biggest comedians of the 20th century was called Bob Hope. And he never wrote a joke in his life.
There you go. And even Garth Brooks, you know, he always just took the best songs. And I think there's no shame in that.
Not
you know,
at
he's still
all.
Garth Brooks.
There's
you
always,
know?
A, there's always
Michael Jackson didn't write Thriller, you know, no. Rod Temperton wrote Thriller and no one cares. So,
I mean, Michael Jackson's particular genius is bloody Michael Jackson. It doesn't have to write everything as well. Listen, I want to reel out a couple of your chapters here. Chapter one, the 10,000 hours. Chapter two, songwriter speed dating. Chapter three, top 10 rules of hitmaking. Chapter five, the psychology of a writing room. Chapter six, the art of staying inspired. Chapter eight, sampling. Mm-hmm. Chapter 10, bad deals versus good deals. Chapter 11, how do we get paid? Music royalties. Chapter 12, the best piece of advice I ever got. Can you say a bit of that?
So I interviewed some of the best and biggest songwriters in the world and artists for this book. So I interviewed everyone from like Dan Wilson, who's Semisonic. So he wrote Someone Like You with Adele. He's the lead singer of Semisonic. So he wrote Closing Time. Like, he's legendary. Mm. And I also interviewed Amy Allen, who is the top songwriter right now. She wrote, Apathé, Espresso, all the Sabrina Carpenter stuff. She's like the biggest songwriter in the world right now. She won the Grammy for Songwriter of the Year, and others like that are just all just at the top of their game. Lauren Christie, who wrote all the Avril Lavigne records, and they all tell stories throughout the book about how they wrote certain songs. So in the book, there's interludes, and the interludes are all song stories about how, from the songwriter's perspective, how these songs came about. And they're so interesting. And I love doing the interviews because as a music fan, I got to hear all these amazing stories. Yeah. But one of the questions I asked everybody was, what was the best piece of advice that they got, you know, in the industry? So there's amazing ones like Julian Bonetto, It's Not Who You Know, It's Who You Avoid. There's another one from Steph Jones, who wrote Espresso, saying don't be an arsehole. I don't know if I can say that, but just be a nice person. Mm. You know, there's loads of gems of these amazing pieces of advice that other creatives got. And I wanted to kind of end the book with that, because a lot of the time those pieces of advice can really help motivate and inspire songwriters to just, you know, keep doing it and not give up and everything like that. Or someone said, you know, you might write your biggest song when you're 39. There's no limit to the age that you can be a hit songwriter or that you can do this. So I just wanted to end it with all those amazing songwriters and their journeys and what the best piece of advice that they ever got that they wanted to pay forward to to the next generation of songwriters.
Yeah, terrific stuff, Ruth Ann. You've given me great energy during the interview, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a really fascinating book now, and it really is, and I would urge people to go out and buy this.
Thank you. There's also an audiobook if anyone doesn't like reading. There's an audiobook which is really good. I'm reading it, and I have people doing the voices of the songwriters of the quotes, so it's really interesting. And there's also a QR code, and you scan it and it brings up the playlist of all the songs I'm talking about, so you can be listening to the song as you're reading what I'm talking about. So yeah, definitely get it. And
it's
thank
called
you so much.
It's Ruth Ann Cunningham, and it's not just a song is the name of the book.
Thank you so much. I love our chats because you're obviously such a music lover and a creative as well, so thanks for such a lovely chat.
My thanks to Ruth Ann Cunningham for coming in and having a great chat with me about all things music, singers and songwriters. And also, don't forget to buy her new book. It's not just a song. I've been flicking through it. It's absolutely brilliant, I have to say. My thanks also to Hum Finance for coming on board as sponsors of the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Hum is a finance company based in Ireland, 30 years experience globally, and you can make payments in bite-size, easy-to-pay-back payments. It couldn't be easier for any of the big things or little things in life. They're here in Ireland, and they're also here sponsoring the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Thank you, Hum. But most of all, thank you to you, the listener, for, as usual, tuning in. If you love it, just tell one other person that you enjoy this podcast, and I'd be delighted. Thank you very much. See you same time, same place next week.
The Mario Rosenstock podcast. Thanks to Hum. Finance made easy when you shop tech, electrical, appliances, kitchens, and much more. Flexify Europe Limited, trading as Hum, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.